Anyone there? Can anyone hear me?
Looks like I'm alone. How little did I know that statement was far from true. The Island, Chapter 1. Castaway. The beach seemed to go on forever. It stretched for as far as I could see. There was no sign of the Mary Perrin anywhere, either intact or as a wreckage. And there didn't appear to be any sort of life on the beach either. Normally, beaches are abundant with life, with seagulls, crabs, insects, jellyfish. Was absolutely barren. I walked for a good 20 minutes while I tried to find anything that I could use for shelter, but aside from the occasional piece of driftwood, I had no luck. With nothing on the beach, I turned my attention inland. About 200 feet away were these tall cliffs, maybe 50 feet in height. Now, I wouldn't describe myself as muscle-bound. In fact, I was quite scrawny back then. But something at the back of my mind told me that if I was going to find shelter, that's where it would be. So I did what I had to. As I approached the cliffs, I felt this knot of anxiety build up in my stomach. But this is survival. If you want to live, you've got to put your fear aside. So I did what I had to. I started climbing. I felt the ocean breeze at my back. As cool and refreshing as it was, by the time I got to the top, I was drenched in sweat. Fortunately, my hunch was correct. When I got to the top, a massive forest of palm trees was there to greet me. The foliage was ungodly thick, but at least it looked traversable. As I stood there watching the forest, I was almost in awe at the beauty that was before me. But standing around wasn't going to do a damn thing. I needed to find food and shelter. Well, nothing ventured, nothing gained, right? Jesus, I'm talking to myself now. I must have hit my head harder than I thought. Now, let's see. As I finally reached the forest, I noticed, like the beach below, there was no sign of life. No animals, no bird calls, nothing. The palm trees did have coconuts on them, so at least I wouldn't starve. But I didn't know the first thing about climbing a tree. I must have walked a good 4 hours, meandering aimlessly. As the sun made its way overhead towards the horizon, I realized that I was running out of time. If I was going to find shelter, I'd need to find it soon. As I slowed down from exhaustion, hunger, and thirst, I started hearing something in the distance. Hmm? What's that? It almost sounds like... No way! Oh, a river! I couldn't believe my luck. A source of fresh water. I thanked whatever gods were watching out for me as I took my clothes off. I took several steps back. Then I bolted, jumped, and shouted... Banzai! Woo! That's cold. Oh, this feels great. I needed this. I waded about in the river, letting the cold water soothe my aching muscles. For the briefest of moments, all of the worries and anxieties that I had just washed away in the river. But then I felt something. There was something, or rather, multiple somethings, that tickled past my legs. When the water calmed, I looked down and smiled at what I saw. Fish! Specifically, Pacific salmon. I'd had it before, so I knew what it looked like. I just hadn't expected to see any, especially this far inland. All right, you little bastards, hold still. Okay, try again. Ugh, for fuck's sake, how the hell do bears make this look so easy? The answer, of course, was that bears were bears. And I was a 25-year-old man wading about in waist-deep water, flailing like an idiot. Of course, that had been a rhetorical question. It's not like anyone was nearby who could answer me. Was there? Regardless, after 10 minutes of trying to grab the fish, I realized that this wasn't working. I waded back to the shore, where I then grabbed my shirt. I then tied off the sleeves and gripped the collar shut. Heading back out into the river, I waited for more salmon to swim by my legs. As soon as I felt that tickle, I made my move. Using my shirt as a makeshift net, I caught 3 of them. With my prize in my hands, I waded back to the shore, set it down, and started gathering wood to build a fire. Once I had enough, well, let's just say it took me a while to actually get a fire going. The only thing I had in abundance were stones, and I must have spent 10 minutes fumbling around with them, trying to make sparks that would at least give me some embers. Once I did, though, I nursed the flames with some of the tall grass that was growing around the river. Soon, I had a rather cozy campfire. I took some twigs, put the fish on them, and let them roast over the flames. Let me tell you, I was absolutely famished. I practically inhaled them once they were done. I'd never been that hungry before. By this point, the sun had long gone down. Save for the light coming from the campfire, the night was almost pitch black. Now full, I started to look around for a place where I could rest my head for the night. I came across a cave. The cave itself was about 10 feet in diameter, and I'd say it was about 40 feet deep. With a branch from the fire to provide illumination, I explored the cave. Nothing was in it, so I figured that this was it. I laid down on the soft ground, closed my eyes, and once the branch and campfire had burned out, I was in total darkness. At least, I thought I was. When I opened my eyes, I noticed that there was a source of light coming in from the cave. I got up and walked towards it. Small beams of light were coming out from cracks in the cave wall. As I put my hands on it to investigate, I felt a metal handle. Ever the curious one, I then turned it and pulled. Well, what do you know? Opening the false cave wall back revealed a flight of stairs going down. The source of light was coming from below. Naturally, I followed the stairs. When I got to the bottom, I appeared to be in what looked like some sort of large bunker. There were 2 rows of 4 desks in the bunker. All of the desks had ancient computers on them. Old IBM compatibles. Compacts, mostly. All but one of them were badly damaged. It's like someone had taken a battle axe to them. Still, the computers did pique my interest. I sat down at the desk that contained the single working computer. The old CRT monitor was caked in dust. It took me a minute to clean off the screen. With that done, I started looking for the power switch on the tower.
Now where it...
Ah! Found it. It was on the back of the machine. I have no idea why computer companies put the power switch on the back of the towers. But, judging from the age of the machine, I cut it some slack. Okay, my old friend, let's see if you can power on. Ah, good. CRT works. Man, this thing's old. I haven't used a CRT in, like, 10 years. Well, since the monitor can turn on, there's electricity here. And whatever's generating it is still working, so that's good. Now, let's see if I can turn the machine on. Okay, passes the smoke test. All right, we're working! Launching MS-DOS 4.01. Whoa, that's older than I am. Okay, let's see what's on this old... Whoa! What the hell?
Alert! Alert! Critical system failure. Automatic shutdown protocol initiated.
Shutdown?
Alert! Alert! Critical system failure. Automatic shutdown protocol initiated.
Fuck!
Automatic shutdown complete. Running diagnostic.
Okay, don't panic. That'll tell me what's wrong.
Diagnostic complete. There is a fatal hardware error in section 88 lambda. Contact system administrator immediately. Repeat, contact system administrator immediately. This automated message will now terminate.
Okay, where the hell's 88 lambda? And what the hell's going on? I tried turning the machine back on to see if it was an isolated incident, but every time I got to a certain point at the boot up, I got the same error message blaring over the speakers. Critical system failure in 88 lambda. I tried opening the case to take a look at the components, but they appeared to be fine. And I couldn't find a PCB labeled 88 lambda. So, wherever that was, it wasn't in the machine itself. As I put the machine back together, I realized that it was networked. There was a cable going from the tower to a socket in the wall. I disconnected the cable going to the computer and turned it back on. It would boot up, and I didn't get any error messages. When I took a look at the systems directory, though, it was empty. No files were saved on the local hard drive. I concluded that this 88 lambda must be some sort of a file server. Realizing that I'd done everything I could with the computer, I turned it off, got up, and started exploring this bunker to see if this 88 lambda was located inside. I couldn't find a file server anywhere in the bunker, but I did find something else. I found dozens of tin cans, and they were still sealed. They had food in them. I found just as many boxes and containers of dried food as well. It's a shame I'd already eaten, though. At least this meant I could supplement the fish. Having explored every nook and cranny of the bunker, I returned upstairs to the cave. Having exhausted myself, both physically and mentally, I had no problems falling asleep. Though, the dream that I had was very disturbing. I was floating over a pile of corpses. Bloodied, mangled, hacked to pieces. There was the sound coming from all around me like banging or a heartbeat, and these two glowing red eyes were staring at me from the distance. Huh? Where am I? Is this... Am I dreaming? Huh? Who are you? And what is this place? I don't understand what you're saying. You'll be watching me? Wait!
Wait!
I awoke from that weird dream with a start.
Oh, Jesus.
My heart was beating so fast and so loud that I could hear it in my ears. It took me a while to calm down. It was only a dream, I told myself. Early morning light was flooding into the cave, and I was starting to feel rather hungry. All of the canned and dry food that was in that strange computer room, well, since I couldn't open the tins or actually do any cooking, might as well have just not been there. So the only thing that was on the menu was fish that I had to catch myself. Looks like I'm gonna have to go fishing for breakfast. God damn it, I'd do anything for Dad's old fishing kit. I then heard a sound that I didn't expect to hear. Huh? Something or someone had jumped into the river, but that was impossible. As far as I knew, I was the only person alive on this island. Could it be? Could it be that I wasn't alone? I had to investigate. I bolted as fast as my legs could take me. Once I made it outside, I started looking around for the source of that splash. I saw ripples on the surface, so someone had jumped in. I then heard something breach the water. I turned and saw who it was. It was a woman, and she was humming to herself. She didn't look that much older than me. Maybe a little younger, actually. 23, 24. She was bathing in the river. Her skin was very tanned. I could also see a lot of old scars and scratches across her body. Her long, brown hair went down to about her waist, and she was beautiful. The odds of me surviving on this island had gone up. Then again, wasn't the only thing to go up. I mean, here I was, watching a beautiful, naked woman bathing in the river. Where was I? Oh, right. I crouched down low and tried to hide myself in the rather tall grass. I tried looking for tracks to see where she had come from, but there was just one small problem. I was about as stealthy as a brick. Crap. So much for trying to sneak around. We locked eyes with each other. I could see in those deep blue eyes a strong sense of fear. I slowly rose up to my full height and held up my hands to show that I was unarmed. I tried to speak, but my throat just clogged up. The only sound that I could make was... That must have freaked her out, because she turned and made a break for it. Huh? Hey! Wait up!
Dear God, what does she eat? Rocket fuel?
When I collapsed on the grass, well, to say that I was winded would have been a gross understatement. That woman was fast. She could have given Sonic the Hedgehog a run for his money. Or rings, or... you know what I mean. Once I caught my breath a few minutes later, I kept walking in the direction where that woman had run off. But it soon became evident that I lost her. She could have been halfway across the island at the speed she was going. I then came to the realization that I still hadn't eaten anything. And chasing after that woman had done nothing but expend energy that I could have used doing anything else, like fishing. As I made my way back to the river, though, something out of the corner of my eye caught my attention. It looked like some kind of hut or cabin made of wood. I must have missed it in the chase. I cautiously approached. I could also see a garden of various fruits and vegetables growing next to the cabin. In terms of surface area, it was about the same size as the cabin, if not a little bigger, and it looked fairly well tended to. I could see solar panels on the roof, and several small antennas as well. The front door was wide open. I carefully made my way to the door, and peeked inside. For a cabin, it was fairly well furnished. Along the far wall was a large desk with huge stacks of papers and books. A smaller desk next to it had a computer of some sort, and it was running. To my right was a small dining area and kitchenette. To my left, a rather comfortable-looking bed. There were papers everywhere strewn about the floor. I stepped inside, making sure not to step on any of them, though that proved to be a bit more difficult than I had thought. I walked towards the desk that had the computer. No way! A Commodore Amiga! A Model 2000! You don't see those anymore. Commodore International had gone bankrupt back in 1994, and the Amiga wasn't a very popular computer in North America, which was firmly entrenched in the PC-compatible market. The Amiga had seen considerable success in Europe, primarily in the United Kingdom. In fact, Commodore UK was the only division of the company that made money, but it was insufficient to keep Commodore International afloat. And when Commodore International went bankrupt, Commodore UK made a bid to purchase all of its assets. I'm getting way off topic here. I turned the monitor on, revealing that a program was running. It was some sort of a scanning or monitoring program. It had a diagram of the entire island, and there were these six-digit numbers that were fluctuating up and down wildly all across the island. They seemed to be spots that were being monitored. But monitored for what? Before I could investigate any further, I heard a voice at the door. I froze in terror and slowly turned to face the source of the voice. It was a woman, but not the same woman I'd met earlier. In fact, she looked like she was maybe in her late 60s or early 70s. She kept her hair tied neatly in a bun, and seemed to be wearing an old lab coat that had seen better days. Before I could make a sound, she approached. She didn't seem angry or surprised, more curious than anything else. She put her hand on my forehead, as if to see whether I was real. She seemed satisfied with this, then nodded and spoke.
Hello.
Hi.
Who might you be?
I'm very sorry for entering your cabin, but, I'm Perrin. Richard Perrin, though. I go by Rick.
Well, it's a pleasure to meet you, Mr. Perrin. I'm Dr. Carla Francis. How exactly did you manage to arrive here?
Well, that's the thing. My yacht. Something happened to my yacht. I was 8 days out from Vancouver, and engine wouldn't start. I couldn't get my radio to work. It's like everything on the ship failed, and there was some sort of strong interference on the radio. A freak storm hit, and a massive wave knocked me overboard. I woke up on the beach. That was yesterday, I think.
Yes, that would make sense.
Come again? How would that make sense? It still doesn't make sense to me.
Please take a seat, Mr. Perrin, and make yourself comfortable. You're the first guest I've had in a very long time, and there is much that I must discuss with you.
Okay?
Well, then. First, welcome to Ulea Island, the Pacific's perfect paradise. There is a powerful electromagnetic anomaly at its core, one which disables all machinery and electronic equipment.
Okay, so how did that affect my ship?
You must have crossed the anomaly's threshold. It extends outwards from Ulea Island like a 50-kilometer-wide dome. There is, however, a way to protect most electronics from the anomaly's effects.
Oh? How?
Multiple bunkers and outposts were erected here. All of them are outfitted with a special metallic alloy that shields everything inside from the anomaly.
I think I came across one of those bunkers.
You have?
Yeah, it was hidden in the back of a cave, not far from here.
Well, that is good news. Tell me, the equipment inside, is it still operational?
Well, I could get one of the computers to boot up, but it said that there was some sort of a critical hardware failure. Section 88 Lambda. Would you happen to know where that is, Doctor?
Section 88 Lambda. If memory serves, Section 88 Lambda is located in the central tower. But I wouldn't dare go there. It's been abandoned since the... For at least 20 years. After all of this time, it would be in a very poor state of repair.
Central Tower? I'm afraid you lost me, Doctor.
Of course. The Central Tower was built as a base of operations for Operation Nisoy.
Operation what?
Operation Nisoy was an international expedition to explore Urea Island and discover what causes the anomaly. In 1979, an American maritime survey team discovered the island purely by accident, much like yourself. When the team returned to the United States, they gave their findings directly to President Carter. In turn, he secretly commissioned the creation of Project Nisoy. America, Canada, Mexico, the United Kingdom, France, Belgium, Spain, Portugal, West Germany, Japan, and South Korea all lent their best scientific minds to the project, with the American Science Research Council spearheading the project. Our goal was to catalog the island, analyze the anomaly, and determine what caused it.
Okay, I'm with you so far.
The bunker's outpost and central tower began construction the following year, though our research didn't begin in earnest until 1982. It started smoothly enough, but by 1985, several of the researchers began to behave rather irrationally.
Irrationally? What do you mean?
They would experience hallucinations, hear voices in their heads, and become increasingly paranoid.
Oh.
At first, we had assumed that this was due to the isolation. We had been working on Project Nisoy for 3 solid years, so it would make sense that nerves would be frayed. Those who exhibited these symptoms were dismissed, with fresh minds replacing them. It wasn't until 1989 that we discovered the anomaly's electromagnetic field caused severe neurological and cerebral degradation after prolonged exposure. Additional precautions and protective measures were put in place, but sadly, they were insufficient.
How?
More researchers exhibited these symptoms.
Oh.
The neurological degradation affects everyone differently and at a different rate. With that said, however, the children who were born on Urea Island were somehow immune to the anomaly and its effects.
Immune? How did they get this immunity?
We discovered trace particles of the protective metallic alloy in the bloodstream of every person who had prolonged exposure within the bunkers, outposts, and the tower. Now, these particles were harmless. In fact, we observed on more than one occasion white blood cells completely ignoring them. Since they posed no danger, we paid them no heed. With that said, however, we found it curious that none of the children had started showing any sign of the aforementioned symptoms. This warranted further investigation, and we discovered that every single child that had either been conceived or born here had those particles bonded directly into their cells.
Wow!
We concluded that this is what brought about their immunity.
Then, that woman that I met earlier...
Her name is Amelia.
Amelia?
She is the last surviving child that was born here.
Wait. Last? What happened? There was a long silence. I could tell from the look on her face that I was bringing up painful memories.
In October of 1992, we came to the startling conclusion that the anomaly was growing, and at an unprecedented rate. The EM field that it produced was becoming more powerful, and it soon became evident that the additional protective measures we brought in simply weren't working. Dr. Aaron Tillman, a chemical engineer and a colleague of mine, managed to create this.
She reached into her lab coat and took out a vial filled with a strange, silvery, translucent liquid.
This is a serum that temporarily nullifies the anomaly's effects on organic life. We had intended on distributing it to the others after we had synthesized enough, but we never got the chance to. A biologist from Japan, Dr. Kazuhiro Maruyama, became violently paranoid. He attacked several of us in the tower before we managed to restrain him. We placed him in a makeshift prison cell while we discussed what we should do next, but he somehow escaped. He went on a rampage, critically injuring and killing well over 2 dozen of us. We attempted to call for help, but he destroyed the radio equipment we used to contact the outside world. And he killed the only technicians who knew how to repair them. It was a bloodbath.
I put my hands on the doctor's shoulders to try to calm her down, but I knew that there was nothing I could say or do that could help.
As Maruyama went on his rampage, I gathered 9 other people, a 6-month-old Amelia, her father, and 7 other researchers. I managed to seal ourselves in one of the island's bunkers, where we waited. I don't remember how long we were there, but when we opened the bunker's door, we were in shock at the carnage that lay before us. Maruyama spared no one, not even the other children.
Oh my God.
There were signs of a struggle. I can only assume that the others somehow fought back and killed Maruyama before succumbing to their injuries. We tried to repair what we could, but we were critically understaffed and had no way of communicating with the outside world. We had assumed that the American Science Research Council would have gotten concerned about the lack of contact from us and would have sent a rescue party. We waited. Days turned to weeks. Weeks turned to years. Finally, by New Year's of 1994, we gave up hope of a rescue. We attempted to make Urea Island our home. We settled it as best as we could, but as the decade wore on, the anomaly claimed the sanity of more and more of us. I synthesized more of the serum to distribute it, but after a while, it would lose its effectiveness. Rather than risk going insane, the others, they chose to end their lives when they felt their minds slipping.
I felt a chill go down my spine as she uttered those words.
The last researcher took his life 10 years ago. Ever since then, it has only been Amelia and myself. And a week ago, I experienced my first hallucination. The serum is no longer effective on me.
Then, I suppose it's a good thing that I washed ashore yesterday.
How so?
My father is the co-owner of one of Canada's largest tech firms. I've been around computers my entire life. I mean, I just finished my 3rd year of computer science. I've also been fixing them since I was 12. Hell, I built my first radio out of spare parts when I was 15. Sure, the gear you have here is long obsolete, but the basics are still the same.
Then you can repair the damaged equipment?
I don't know, but I'm going to give it my all. But I'm going to need reference material, like user manuals, blueprints, anything like that. And I'm going to need tools.
In that case, take this.
She reached into her lab coat and took out a set of old keys and placed them in my hand.
These are the keys to the central tower and the outposts. I saved the texts of every technician and placed them in the outpost northeast of here. It's a 2-floored stone building. You can't miss it.
Perfect. That's where I'll start.
Also, if you can, see if you can get Amelia's assistance. She lives in a hut at the North Cape. She could teach you how to survive here.
Huh. I think I'll go find her first, then. I mean, there's really no point in trying to fix anything if I end up dead.
She's usually foraging around this time of day. When you find her, tell her that you've met me. She's quite wary of strangers. We've had unfortunate encounters with the natives of neighboring islands. She may think that you're one of them.
All right, then. Thank you for everything, Doctor, and I'll see you later. Don't know when I'll be back, but... Right. I haven't eaten anything yet.
Oh, I see. Well, in that case, it would hardly be right of me to send you off in such a state. There's a garden behind my hut where I've been cultivating some different fruits and vegetables here. Please help yourself to some before you leave.
Oh, thank you so much. After getting my fill of fruits and vegetables, I then made my way towards the North Cape. It was noon by the time I got there, and there she was. She was wearing old, worn leathers. There was a sheathed dagger strapped to her right thigh, and her hair blew about in the wind. She was facing the ocean. I don't know if she heard me as I approached. That's her. Amelia? Next time on the island. Well, this is certainly not what I expected. Cold, aloof, and distant are three words that I'd use to describe Amelia. It's Pacific Island boot camp as she trains me on survival. How do I get her to open up? How do I prove to her that I'm not her enemy? Find out in Chapter 2, Survivors.